Chapter 7. Prioritize and Execute. Leif Babin. South Central Ramadi, Iraq. The Hornet's Nest. All day, murderous bursts of machine gun fire hammered our position, shattering windows and impacting interior walls, each round with the violence and kinetic energy of a sledgehammer wielded at full force. Some of the incoming rounds were armor-piercing and punched right through the thick concrete of the low wall surrounding the rooftop. All our element of SEALs, EOD bomb technicians, and Iraqi soldiers could do under such accurate enemy fire was hit the deck and try not to get our head shot off. Rounds snapped inches above us, and shards of glass and concrete fragments rained down everywhere. "Damn, some of these bastards can shoot," yelled a SEAL operator, pressed as close to the floor as humanly possible. We couldn't help but laugh at our predicament. RPG-7 rockets followed in rapid sequence of three or four, exploding with tremendous concussion against the exterior walls. Hunkered down inside the building, we were separated from the bone-jarring explosions and deadly shrapnel by a foot or so of concrete. One errant RPG rocket missed its mark and sailed high over the building, trailing across the hazy, cloudless Iraqi summer sky like a bottle rocket on an American 4th of July. But if just one of those rockets impacted a window, it meant red-hot fragments of jagged metal ripping through just about every man in the room. Despite the onslaught, we held our position in the large four-story apartment building. When the fury of the attack subsided, our SEAL snipers returned fire with devastating effect. As armed enemy fighters maneuvered through the streets to attack, SEAL snipers squeezed off round after round with deadly accuracy, confirming 10 enemy fighters killed and a handful more probable kills. As the platoon commander in charge of the entire element, I made my way from room to room on each floor to get a status check and make sure none of our guys were hit. Gathering information on our snipers' engagements, I passed situational reports over the radio to the U.S. Army's TOC in the distant friendly combat outpost. "You guys good?" I asked, ducking into a room with SEAL snipers and machine gunners manning positions while others took a break. "Good to go," came the response. In another room, I checked in with our SEAL platoon chief. Just then, enemy fire poured through the windows, bracketing his position as he pressed against the corner wall. He laughed and gave me a thumbs up. Chief was a badass. SEAL machine gunners came looking for work, and we directed their fire at the enemy's location. The gunners quickly hammered the enemy position with an accurate barrage of 7.62mm link. One SEAL gunner, Ryan Job, eagerly employed his big machine gun with deadly accuracy. He fearlessly stood in the window, braving incoming enemy rounds as he unleashed 3 to 5 round bursts of his own into insurgent positions. A group of armed insurgents tried to sneak up even closer to us, using the concealment of a sheep pen to hide their movement. Ryan hammered them and beat back their attempt before it could even materialize. The sheep in the pen took some heavy casualties in the crossfire. "Damn," I told him. "Those sheep took some heavies." "They were moose sheep," Ryan laughed. I lobbed several 40mm high-explosive grenades at a doorway where Chief had seen enemy fighters engaging us. "Whoomp!" sounded the explosion as one round landed right inside the doorway with a fiery blast. That should keep their heads down for a little while at least. Long before dawn broke that morning, before the day's first call to prayer echoed from the minaret speakers of the many mosques across South Central Ramadi, our group of Charlie Platoon SEALs, our EOD operators, who were very much a part of our platoon, an interpreter, and Iraqi soldiers had stealthily foot patrolled under the cover of darkness through the dusty, rubble-strewn streets. We had BTF'd in, as our chief called it. BTF stood for Big Tough Frogman, an unofficial mantra adopted by Charlie Platoon. BTF entailed taking on substantial physical exertion and great risk and persevering by simply being a big, tough frogman. Pushing deep inside enemy territory was a BTF evolution. We knew it likely meant a gunfight was in store for us, what Chief called a big mix-it-up. Our routine for most of these operations, in Chief's terminology, was this: BTF in, big mix-it-up, BTF out. Then, once back on base, we'd hit the mess hall for Big Chow. We had patrolled out of Cop Falcon in the early morning darkness through the densely packed urban neighborhood of two-story houses, adjoining compound walls, and heavy-duty metal gates. We BTF'd in on foot for about 1.5 kilometers, carrying our heavy gear and substantial firepower, into another violent, enemy-held neighborhood of the city, an area firmly in the grasp of a brutal insurgency. Driven back from the areas to the east and west, enemy fighters chose to stand and fight for this dirty patch of ground in the city's geographic center. We took position in a building just up the street from a mosque that frequently rallied the call to jihad from its minaret speakers to the hundreds of well-armed Muj that occupied this area. Not long before, off this very street, a large force of enemy fighters had attacked a squad of U.S. Marines and pinned them down for several hours before they could evacuate their wounded. 2 weeks before, only a half block to the south, that street witnessed the destruction of a heavily armored U.S. mine clearance vehicle by the massive blast of an IED. Nearly a dozen American tanks and armored vehicles had been destroyed in this section of the city. The vehicle graveyard back at Camp Ramadi became the final resting place for their charred wreckage. The burned-out hulks of blackened, twisted metal stood as a stark reminder of the intensity of violence in the streets and the many wounded and killed. Our SEAL platoon had chosen this particular building for its commanding views of the area. Most important, it was right in the enemy's backyard. Here, insurgent fighters had enjoyed complete safe haven and freedom of movement. The frequent and intense onslaught of enemy machine gun fire and RPG rockets now served as a testament that our presence here was most unwelcome. We had stirred up a hornet's nest, but it was exactly where we wanted to be. Our plan, go where the bad guys would least expect us in order to seriously disrupt their program, kill as many enemy fighters as we could, and decrease their ability to attack nearby U.S. Army and Marine combat outposts. We wanted the enemy to know that they no longer could enjoy safe haven here. This neighborhood was no longer theirs. We owned this ground. Pushing this far into enemy territory carried tremendous risks. Though the nearest U.S. combat outpost was not more than 1.5 kilometers or so in a straight line distance from our position, the extreme IED threat and heavy enemy presence could render any support we needed from tanks or armored vehicles extremely hazardous and difficult, if not impossible. Although our army brethren would come to our aid if we called, we knew we would be putting them at great risk to do so. It was a tactic we had learned from the U.S. Marine companies stationed along the main route through the city. Unless we had an urgent casualty, we would hold our position, hunkered down right where we were. We would not call in vehicles or additional troops and put them at risk unless we took serious casualties and absolutely needed them. The apartment building our SEAL platoon now occupied provided an excellent tactical position. With a higher vantage point above the buildings around us, its thick concrete walls provided some protection from enemy fire. There was only one problem. The building had only one entrance and exit from the second story, a narrow stairway leading down to the street. There was no way of watching the entrance or the street surrounding it during daylight without exposure to enemy fire. This meant the enemy could possibly emplace IEDs near the entrance while we were inside and detonate them on us as we exited. We had heard stories of how this had happened to a Marine sniper team and other American units during our tour. To counter the threat, my chief and I considered occupying a house across the street that would allow us to watch the entrance, but we didn't have the manpower. With no viable alternative, it was a vulnerability we were forced to accept. To mitigate the risk of an IED being planted at the doorstep, the EOD operators studied the area in detail around the exit door and planned a meticulous sweep for explosives prior to our anticipated departure later that night. The onslaught of heavy enemy fire continued frequently throughout the day, with periods of intense violence and periods of calm. Enemy fighters attacked from multiple directions, and SEAL snipers engaged and killed many of them. Our SEAL machine gunners returned fire into enemy positions with devastating effect. Other SEALs fired LAW rockets, light anti-armor weapon, and 40-millimeter grenades at enemy fighters hiding behind concrete walls. Even the Iraqi soldiers, typically far more focused on self-preservation, joined in the fight and returned fire with their AK-47s and PKC belt-fed machine guns. As the day faded and the sun dipped below the horizon, the attacks diminished. Gunfire and explosions subsided, With the darkness, an eerie quiet descended upon Ramadi, broken only by the evening call to prayer that echoed across the dusty rooftops. Our SEAL platoon and Iraqi soldiers packed our gear and prepared to depart. Remembering the vulnerability of the single exit to the street, our two EOD bomb technicians went to work. Peering over the second-story balcony through their night-vision goggles, they scanned the area around the exit door and the surrounding street, littered with trash and potholes, in some places scarred by the craters of previous IED blasts. But something was out of place. Something looked different than when they had scanned the area in the early morning darkness before dawn. An otherwise unobtrusive item lay against the building wall, only feet from the exit door, covered with a plastic tarp. Just a tiny sliver of a smooth, cylindrical object peeked out from under the edge of the tarp. "Something looks suspicious," an EOD operator relayed to me. It was most unwelcome news, as the stairway to the street was our only easy means of departure. I called a huddle with Chief, our leading petty officer, or LPO, and our platoon junior officers. "We need to figure another way out of here," I said. That was no easy task. From the second story, three sides of the building offered a nearly 20-foot drop from a window or balcony straight down to the street. We had no rope. Jumping with all our gear and heavy equipment was likely to result in serious injury, and that same street had at least one explosive device. We had to assume there were more. Somebody suggested a children's cartoon prison escape method. What if we tied bed sheets together and climbed down from the third-story windows onto the rooftop next door? It was a harebrained idea, but under the circumstances, an option that had to be seriously considered. The fourth and remaining wall of the second story was solid concrete with no windows, doors, or openings. We certainly couldn't go around it or over it, but we could go through it. "Looks like it's time to BTF," said the LPO. It meant we were about to tackle another serious feat of strength and toughness that would challenge us to our physical limits. But Charlie Platoon took great pride in accomplishing such feats. "Let's get our sledgehammer on." We always carried a sledgehammer with us to make entry through locked doors and windows when necessary. The LPO called for the sledge and went to work. He began swinging the hammer with full force against the concrete wall, each swing impacted with a loud, head-jarring thwack. He and a handful of other SEALs rotated every few minutes as they hammered through the thick wall. It was painfully slow, back-breaking work. We needed a hole big enough for operators with rucksacks and heavy gear to walk through onto the flat rooftop of the one-story building next door. In the meantime, our EOD operators carefully went to work on the IED planted at our doorstep. Through meticulous investigation, they uncovered two 130-millimeter rocket projectiles whose nose cones were packed with Semtex, a plastic explosive. Had they not discovered the device, and had we triggered it, the massive explosion and deadly shrapnel could have wiped out half our platoon. We couldn't leave this IED here to kill other U.S. soldiers, Marines, or innocent Iraqi civilians. So EOD carefully set their own explosive charge on it to set it off or blow it in place where it lay. Once prepared, the EOD operators notified me and waited for the command to pop smoke and ignite the time fuse that would initiate the charge. After a solid 20 minutes of furious sledgehammering, the LPO and his rotating crew of BTF SEALs finally broke through the concrete wall. They were winded and sweating profusely in the sweltering heat, but we now had an alternate exit that would enable us to circumvent the IED threat. Everyone double-checked their gear to ensure we left nothing behind. Then we lined up next to the jagged hole in the wall and made ready to exit the building. "Stand by to break out," I said over the inter-squad radio. SEALs and Iraqi soldiers shouldered their rucksacks. "Pop smoke," I passed to the waiting EOD techs. One pop smoke while the other started a stopwatch that counted down to detonation. We now had only a few minutes to get everyone to a safe distance from what would be a significant blast. Swiftly, we pushed through the jagged hole in the concrete and onto the flat, dusty rooftop of the adjacent building. SEAL shooters fanned out, scanning for threats, weapons trained on the darkened windows and rooftops of the higher buildings surrounding us. Tactically, this was a hell of a bad position. A wide-open rooftop with no cover, surrounded by higher buildings all around, deep in the enemy's backyard, after having taken heavy fire all day. We need a head count. Make sure we got everybody, I said to the LPO. The LPO had already positioned himself for this and was making it happen. Suddenly, a seal moving along the edge of the rooftop just steps ahead of me, crashed through the roof, and fell 20 feet to the ground, landing hard with a loud smack on the concrete. Holy shit, I thought, standing just behind him. This was crazy. What had appeared in the darkness to be the edge of the rooftop was actually only a plastic tarp covered with dust. In an instant, things had spiraled into mayhem. The seal lay on the ground, groaning in pain. We called down to him and tried to contact him via his radio. Hey, you all right? I asked. There was no response. The seals up ahead immediately tried to find a way down to him, but the door to the only stairway leading down from the rooftop was blocked by a gate of heavy iron bars, chained and locked. This was bad. Dreadfully exposed on a wide-open rooftop with no cover, we were completely surrounded by higher, tactically superior positions in the heart of an extremely dangerous, enemy-controlled area. Large numbers of enemy fighters had total freedom of movement here and had attacked us throughout the day and knew our location. Even worse, the clock was ticking on an explosive charge that would set off a huge IED blast, throwing deadly metal fragments or frag in all directions. Our SEAL element did not yet have a full headcount to ensure all personnel were out of the building, and now one of our SEALs lay helplessly alone and unable to defend himself on the most dangerous street of the nastiest enemy-held area in Ramadi, and we couldn't get to him. His neck or back might be broken. His skull could be fractured. We had to get a SEAL corpsman, our combat medic, to him immediately. But we could not even reach him without breaking through a locked iron gate to get to the street below. The massive pressure of the situation bore down on me. This was a hell of a dilemma, one that could overwhelm even the most competent leader. How could we possibly tackle so many problems at once? Prioritize and execute. Even the greatest battlefield leaders could not handle an array of challenges simultaneously without being overwhelmed. That risked failing at them all. I had to remain calm, step back from my immediate emotional reaction, and determine the greatest priority for the team. Then, rapidly direct the team to attack that priority. Once the wheels were in motion and the full resources of the team were engaged in that highest priority effort, I could then determine the next priority, focus the team efforts there, and then move on to the next priority. I could not allow myself to be overwhelmed. I had to relax, look around, and make a call. That was what prioritize and execute was all about. Through dozens of intense training scenarios throughout the previous year, our SEAL platoon and task unit had rehearsed in chaotic and difficult situations. That training was designed to overwhelm us, to push us far outside our comfort zone, and force us to make critical decisions under pressure. Amid the noise, mayhem, and uncertainty of the outcome, we had practiced the ability to remain calm, step back from the situation mentally, assess the scenario, decide what had to be done, and make a call. We had learned to prioritize and execute. This process was not intuitive to most people, but could be learned, built upon, and greatly enhanced through many iterations of training. Here, I recognized our highest priority, and I gave the broad guidance to execute on that priority with a simple command: set security. Though I, like everyone else in our platoon, wanted desperately to help our wounded man lying in the street below, the best way for us to do that was by occupying the strongest tactical position to defend ourselves. With threats all around and above us, we needed SEAL shooters in covering positions with weapons ready to engage any enemy threat to the men on the exposed rooftop, those SEALs and others still exiting the building, and the wounded man lying helpless in the street below. Chief immediately stepped in and started directing shooters flowing to the hole in the wall and onto the rooftop. "Give me some guns over here," he shouted. Within moments, we had weapons, and in particular, machine gunners in key covering positions, and had security set. Second, the next priority, find a way to get everyone off the exposed rooftop and get to our wounded man. To accomplish this, the SEALs up front needed a SEAL breacher to break through the locked iron gate to a stairwell that led down to the street. All the training had imparted the instinct of prioritize and execute on the whole platoon. The entire team would simultaneously assess problems, figure out which one was most important with minimal direction from me, and handle it before moving on to the next priority problem. And the SEALs up front, who could see the locked gate, got the job done with no direction needed. With a simple breacher up call, a breacher quickly moved forward and went to work on the gate to break through. Third, the next priority, ensure a full head count of all personnel and confirm they had exited the building to a safe distance from the imminent explosion. Head count, I called the LPO. Despite the immediate chaos around him, our LPO remained calm, stayed focused, and ensured a proper head count of every single person exiting the building. Within moments, he let me know. "We're up," said the LPO. Everyone was out of the building, which included the operator who had fallen to the street. It was welcome news. In less than a minute, the seal breacher broke through the locked gate. Now, we had a way down to our wounded man, and we could all get the hell off the exposed rooftop. If we got shot at here with no cover, we would take substantial casualties. "Let's move," I urged, as the voice of our chief joined in to assist in this effort, directing shooters to fall back to the stairwell down and keeping shooters with guns up to cover other SEALs as they descended to the street. SEAL shooters rushed down to the street below and set security there with weapons pointed up and down the street. Then others moved to recover the downed man. With that, our entire element followed suit down the stairway and out onto the street. Once down, we moved out quickly to a safe distance from the impending IED blast. There, we halted briefly to double-check our headcount to ensure no one was left behind. Fire team leaders reported to squad leaders, who reported to our LPO, who reported to me, "We're up." In only minutes from the time we exited the building, our SEAL platoon, EOD, and Iraqi soldiers moved out on foot to safety with a full headcount. The deep concussion of the massive blast and huge fireball lit up the night and rained frag down for a full city block in all directions. It was our EOD technician's explosive charge that set off the IED, right on time with their stopwatch. The terrific concussion shattered the stillness of the night. IEDs were devastating and deadly, but no American or Iraqi troops would be wounded or killed by that particular one, thank God. Luckily, the SEAL operator, who had fallen through the roof, had landed on his rucksack, which helped break his fall. He was shaken up with a nasty laceration on his elbow, but was otherwise okay. Upon our return to base, the doc sewed him up, and he was soon out with us again on the next operation. Principal. On the battlefield, countless problems compound in a snowball effect, every challenge complex in its own right, each demanding attention. But a leader must remain calm and make the best decisions possible. To do this, SEAL combat leaders utilize prioritize and execute. We verbalize this principle with this direction: relax, look around, make a call. Even the most competent of leaders can be overwhelmed if they try to tackle multiple problems or a number of tasks simultaneously. The team will likely fail at each of those tasks. Instead, leaders must determine the highest priority task and execute. When overwhelmed, fall back upon this principle: prioritize and execute. Multiple problems in high-pressure, high-stakes environments are not exclusive to combat. They occur in many facets of life, and particularly in business. Business decisions may lack the immediacy of life and death, but the pressures on business leaders are still intense. The success or failure of the team, the department, the company, the financial capital of investors, careers, and livelihoods are at stake. These pressures produce stress and demand decisions that often require rapid execution. Such decision-making for leaders can be overwhelming. A particularly effective means to help prioritize and execute under pressure is to stay at least a step or two ahead of real-time problems. Through careful contingency planning, a leader can anticipate likely challenges that could arise during execution and map out an effective response to those challenges before they happen. That leader and his or her team are far more likely to win. Staying ahead of the curve prevents a leader from being overwhelmed when pressure is applied and enables greater decisiveness. If the team has been briefed and understands what actions to take through such lengthy contingencies, the team can then rapidly execute when those problems arise, even without specific direction from leaders. This is a critical characteristic of any high-performance winning team in any business or industry. It also enables effective, decentralized command. When confronted with the enormity of operational plans and the intricate micro-terrain within those plans, it becomes easy to get lost in the details, to become sidetracked or lose focus on the bigger effort. It is crucial, particularly for leaders at the top of the organization, to pull themselves off the firing line, step back, and maintain the strategic picture. This is essential to help correctly prioritize for the team. With this perspective, it becomes far easier to determine the highest priority effort and focus all energies toward its execution. Then, senior leaders must help subordinate team leaders within their team prioritize their efforts. Just as in combat, priorities can rapidly shift and change. When this happens, communication of that shift to the rest of the team, both up and down the chain of command, is critical. Teams must be careful to avoid target fixation on a single issue. They cannot fail to recognize when the highest priority task shifts to something else. The team must maintain the ability to quickly reprioritize efforts and rapidly adapt to a constantly changing battlefield. To implement, prioritize, and execute in any business, team, or organization, a leader must do the following. Evaluate the highest priority problem. Lay out in simple, clear, and concise terms the highest priority effort for your team. Develop and determine a solution. Seek input from key leaders and from the team where possible. Direct the execution of that solution, focusing all efforts and resources toward this priority task. Move on to the next highest priority problem. Repeat. When priorities shift within the team, pass situational awareness both up and down the chain of command. Don't let the focus on one priority cause target fixation. Maintain the ability to see other problems developing and rapidly shift as needed.
Application to business. Jocko Willink. There was only one major problem. The company was losing money. Through years as a profitable player in the pharmaceutical industry, the company experienced several phases of expansion. All seemed well, but recently, revenues had taken a slight downward trend. At first, that trend could be blamed on market conditions or seasonal discrepancies. But when the downward trend continued, it was clear that the lower revenues had metastasized from temporary setback to the new reality. The CEO of this pharmaceutical company brought me in for leadership training and consultation. The CEO and his executives prepared a state of the company brief that detailed the company's strategic vision in order to improve performance. The brief included multiple sections, each with a number of tasks and projects embedded within. He sat me down and ran through the brief so I could get a feel for what they were doing. It contained a plethora of new initiatives, each with its own set of challenges. First, the CEO planned to launch several lines of new product, each with its own marketing plan. With the aim of expansion, the CEO hoped to establish distribution centers in a dozen new markets in the next 18 to 24 months. Additionally, he planned to break into the laboratory equipment market, which he hoped to sell through their access to doctors and hospitals. The CEO also discussed a new training program designed to educate managers and improve their effectiveness as leaders. Additionally, the company planned a complete website overhaul to update their antiquated site and improve customer experience and branding. Finally, with the aim to improve sales, the CEO also planned to restructure the company's sales force and compensation plan. This entailed an activity management system that could more effectively focus the sales force on income-producing activities and reduce wasted time and effort. The CEO went into great detail through a multitude of very impressive-sounding plans. He was clearly passionate about the company and excited to implement this array of new initiatives to get the company back on track. At the end of the brief, the CEO asked if I had any questions. "Have you ever heard of the military term decisively engaged?" I asked. "No, I haven't. I was never in the military," the CEO replied with a smile. "Decisively engaged," I continued, "is a term used to describe a battle in which a unit locked in a tough combat situation cannot maneuver or extricate themselves. In other words, they cannot retreat. They must win. With all your new initiatives, I would say you have a hell of a lot of battles going on," I observed. "Absolutely. We are spread pretty thin, the CEO acknowledged, wondering where this was going. Of all the initiatives, which one do you feel is the most important? I asked. Which one is your highest priority? That's easy, the CEO quickly answered. The activity management of our sales force is the highest priority. We have to make sure our salespeople are engaged in the right activities. If they aren't getting in front of customers and selling our products, we will no longer be in business, said the CEO. With all that you have planned, do you think your team is clear that this is your highest priority? I asked. Probably not, the CEO admitted. On the battlefield, if the guys on the front line face to face with the enemy aren't doing their jobs, nothing else matters. Defeat is inevitable, I replied. With all your other efforts, all your other focuses, how much actual attention is being given to ensuring your frontline salespeople are doing the best job possible? How much of a difference would it make if you and the entire company gave them 100% of your attention for the next few weeks or months? It would probably make a huge difference, the CEO admitted. As a SEAL, I often saw this with junior leaders on the battlefield, I continued. With so much going on, in the chaos and mayhem, they would try and take on too many tasks at once. It never worked. I taught them to prioritize and execute. Prioritize your problems and take care of them one at a time, the highest priority first. Don't try and do everything at once, or you won't be successful. I explained how a leader who tries to take on too many problems simultaneously will likely fail at them all. What about our other initiatives? The CEO asked. They will help us as well. I'm not saying to throw them away, I replied. They sound like great initiatives that are definitely important. But you won't move the needle on them when you are spread so thin. My suggestion is to focus on one, and when that one is completed, or at least has some real momentum, then you move on to the next one and focus on it. When that one is done, then move on to the next, and so on down the line until you have knocked them all out. Makes sense, the CEO replied. I'll give it a try. He was eager to turn the company's performance around. For the next several months, the CEO focused the efforts of the entire company on supporting the frontline sales force, making it clear that this was the company's highest priority. The lab set up tours for customers. The marketing designers helped create new, informative pamphlets for products. Sales managers set minimum marks for the number of introductory meetings with doctors and medical administrators that the sales force had to achieve each week. The company's marketing team created online videos interviewing their top salespeople on the most successful techniques so that others could watch and learn. It was a full focus of effort on the highest priority initiative to increase the company's business. This focus on a singular initiative unified the efforts of the entire company. Progress was seen quickly and gained momentum. The CEO recognized the traction and the effectiveness of the method. Prioritize and execute.